one about role of the producer and and then some specific sessions.
Okay, should I start?
Yeah.
The concept, I guess, of the producer. I like to think of it in terms of, you know, like if you were producing a show, you know, where you're overseeing lighting, you're making sure you know what the expenses are going to be, getting everybody there on time, putting the right people together, the right crew. And I think, I don't like to think of it in terms of like I am the sort of god of it, or, you know, it's like it's my creative thing.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever I have to offer will come out, and my opinions will come out. But especially, you know, with certain musicians, the way you learn something sometimes is really to hear what they're thinking. You know, because we always want to say, well, why didn't they use this piano player on that date or something? Or, you know, why is this guy using this drummer? And then if you don't let him use it, you don't find out why.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, I mean, especially someone like Randy, you find out in the session, you know, why he uses certain people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it can be various in terms of what it is. I try not to think of it as overblown, that, you know, I think of, you know, my thing is to put the whole thing together, to get a realistic budget, to deal with all the musicians, get the whole thing booked at time, be there, set it all up, understand the recording process, what the tunes are going to be, choosing out the tunes, whether, you know, it's standards or working from what the originals are going to be.
Yeah.
And making everyone comfortable and relaxed, which I think is really important. Some people, I think, work in a high-stress thing, where they make the sessions kind of stressful, and that may just be from, you know, their own thing where they're trying, it's like a battle of egos going on.
Uh-huh.
That's not really my, you know, my way of doing things at all. So, that's pretty much it. You know, what I think of in terms of the role of producer, it's, you know, it used to be someone like Quincy Jones would come in, I guess, you know, in the late 50s when he was an A&R person and working as an in-house producer, where you're writing arrangements and stuff like that. Well, very few producers I know do that,
mm-hmm.
days, you know, to whatever extent.
Yeah.
But you have ideas about things, you know, and it's a matter of getting that across to the artist, getting to try something like that.
And then also, I assume, communicating things to the engineer as well.
Oh, yeah, certainly. You know, that a lot of producers like to work with a specific engineer or certain engineers. I'm pretty much the same, because a lot of it, I mean, I know a little bit about the board itself. I mean, I'm not an electronic genius, but, you know, I know how at least the board works and the EQ and stuff like that and the recording process. But finding someone also when you say, you know, can I get more sizzle or can I get more presence?
Yeah.
They know what to do. They know what you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
Personally. And that just takes time working with different people and watching engineers.
Yeah. Now, give me an example when you guess this is more in post-production, where you talked to the engineer and said, I want more sizzle, or I want more of or less of this.
Yeah, let's say it's a session where you're mixing down. You know, you've recorded it multi-track, now you're going to mix it down.
Mm-hmm.
So now, you know, let's say someone like Billy Higgins is a drummer on a date, and you know that sound he has. You know, he's sitting there, and he's happy and bouncing in his seat. And his cymbal sound, it's not overpowering, but it's got this real happy sizzle,
mm-hmm.
say, and you're not getting that. And, you know, the engineer's job is to be able to get that. So sometimes you want to be able to talk in his terms, but I think you also want to allow him to give him more of a painting of it, and, you know, have him deliver that to you. Because there's a lot of, you know, inexact things, too. It's not like, okay, well, you need to have, you know, this at so many dBs or this type of EQ.
Right.
They can play around in all different ways. I remember, I don't know if you know Jim Anderson, who was an engineer. You know, we were trying to get a certain type of reverb, echo reverb, in with power station, and he ended up running one of the vocals through, they used plate mics they had in the stairwell. And so we just had like a, we had it broadcast at the top of the stairs, and the plate mic picked it up at the bottom. So you had this really different type of reverb without using anything artificial.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have somebody like that that's willing to try different things. Like, what do we think about this? Let's do something a little freaky here.
Yeah.
And
you recall who that was for?
Patricia Barber.
Uh-huh.
Actually, that was the first album she did on Antilles.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. She covered The Temptations. And
right, My Girl, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
See, and something like, actually, My Girl was something that she just kind of, on a break, we were just kind of joking around with.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, we were laughing a lot because Wolfgang, you know, he didn't grow up here, obviously. He didn't know the song at all.
Oh.
So, you know, he just started playing along with it, but had no real context to it. So we, you know, I told Patricia, I said, you know, that would be a great tune for you to do. And so we sent somebody out to go get sheet music. And so Wolfgang would know what the song form was like.
Yeah.
And lyrics and everything. And so she would actually know all the lyrics as well. And we just did it, you know, off the spur of the moment.
And you added the natural reverb was added when she was playing piano.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the first time we talked probably was way back in the mid-80s. You were, what, director of publicity?
Actually,
correct?
I was doing promotion for a while. Yeah,
at Polygram.
Doing regional radio promotion.
Oh, okay.
But I dealt with, you know, I dealt with a lot of writers and stuff.
Uh-huh.
At Polygram.
Yeah. How did what you learned in that context carry over into your work now as a producer? Or is there carryover?
I think, you know, if anything, just extended the people that you know that are interested in this music and their ideas and, you know, that kind of thing. But, you get, just being at a label or whatever, you get to work with musicians closely. I mean, I had known a lot of musicians beforehand, and, you know, talking to them just as on a friendly basis as well.
Yeah.
So if anything, it probably just extended the number of people that are, you can get information from,
mm-hmm.
And how they hear things.
Now, tell me how you came to record and produce Randy Weston.
That's interesting. When I was at Polygram, actually, we put up the first three records. It was Randy doing Monk, Randy doing Ellington, and Randy doing his own compositions. Which was produced by Jean-Philippe Allard,
uh-huh.
In France.
Right.
When I moved over to Antilles, because Polygram US had not been interested in Randy, you know, for release, so they didn't confirm it. So Jean-Philippe called me, because it was part of Ireland, which was a part of Polygram, and said, would you be interested in doing this project in Morocco, because it's really expensive and I can't afford the whole thing, and Polygram US is not interested in, you know, putting money for it. And I said, you know, I knew Randy, and I said, I'd love to. And, you know, we worked out a deal. We both co-produced it with Randy. And what happened, actually, with the project was actually supposed to be done in Morocco with the Ghanaian musicians.
Okay.
And it was just at the start of the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
And all the visas were frozen for getting the Ghanaians into different places, and it just became impossible for us to even travel and get there. And so what we did is we turned it around and we said, okay, let's do the project in New York with all the same musicians that we wanted to use, and we'll bring in a Ghanaian. Yasser Chadli, I don't know if you know him.
Mm.
He's based out of the Bay Area.
Okay.
You got to really look for Ghanaians.
Yeah.
Special group of people. So we brought Yasser over, who actually was a friend of Pharaoh's, and that's how we got hooked up with him. And we did the project there. I mean, it turned out we were very happy with it. Obviously, I'd love to do it one day in Morocco.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was to... we were going to drive a remote truck down there because there's no real recording facilities, and drive it from France down to Spain take it across and just record. I think we're going to record in a plaza, actually.
Oh.
What we wanted to do is we're going to have all the musicians live there for 2 weeks. So they really had a feel for what was going on, eat the food, and rehearse the music, and then record as part of performance as well.
Yeah.
So one day maybe we'll be able to do that.
Well, Weston had been there a good many times, right?
He owned the club, I think, for 9 years.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah.
In Casablanca, actually.
Oh. Now, that project you just described became the Spirits of Our Ancestors.
Right, correct.
Yeah. And so, were any of the sessions done in France, or where did LR figure
into that? No, Jean came to the U.S.
Oh, okay.
So we basically split the cost of the project.
Uh-huh.
For the territories that we had. I had the U.S. and he had the rest of the world.
Okay.
And, you know, we made it feasible.
Now, when this project began, had Randy Weston completely formalized what he wanted to do, and you walked in and
oh yeah,
basically he just nailed it.
Yeah, one of the things that he wanted to do, because you know, Melba Liston had suffered with a stroke, and they go back many years.
Right.
And he had kept in touch with her. He was going out to see her. So part of the thing was also there was the piece that African Sunrise that he had written for Dizzy, that they performed only once actually with Dizzy, in a different group context, I think at the Chicago Jazz Festival. And so that was one of the pieces, but they were all, you know, there were pieces that, some things that I've heard before that he's done either live or on record, and new pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So basically it was the concept, you know, Spirits of Our Ancestors, and Randy's whole, you know, feel about it, and the musicians and the sound that we wanted to get. I mean, having Billy Harper and, you know, Farrah Sanders and Dewey Redman, you know, in the tenor chairs.
Yeah.
And Talib on alto, and you know, that kind of sound it's a raw sound.
Yeah. It's also a sound we tend to associate, maybe because of Abdullah Ibrahim, but with Africa.
Yeah.
Now, for someone myself who spent very little time in studios, and then for readers who spent even less than I have, tell me exactly where you figured into the project, and what was the give and take like on that session? What did you contribute as a producer?
I think that, to be honest, that, you know, a lot of it was between me and Jean-Philippe was just actually the scheduling, getting everybody, flying people that need to be flown in, taking care of everybody, and then going through, you know, the takes, getting the rehearsals down, you know, listening to that. I happen to read music, so it helps sometimes for me, you know, reading the arrangements, but working with, you know, at Melba, just to get the band together for them to understand the range, make sure they have all the right parts. In terms of the actual recording, you know, it's sort of a thing where, you know, getting takes and then, you know, me, Jean-Philippe, and Randy deciding what takes that we liked the best.
Yeah.
You know, and what held and what didn't. And it was kind of a magical session. It was when, you know, there wasn't a lot of stress there.
Yeah.
You know, the music just kind of flowed.
So the three of you listened to playbacks.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, actually the whole band.
Oh, okay. That's what
Because especially Melba's arrangements are really tricky. What I was saying about Melba, too, is Randy wanted to really bring her back in because a lot of people had said, you know, Dizzy and Quincy, and that she really was one of the baddest arrangers of that period. But because she was a woman, she really didn't get the proper respect that she deserved. And then, you know, she had her band for years, and then when she suffered with the stroke, she was unable to play anymore. So one of the things that she could still do with the use of the computer was to be able to write. And so that was the whole thing of her writing all these arrangements for these people and writing specifically for these people.
Okay. I really like that recording Weston did years before with her called Tanja.
Oh, Tanja was a great record.
Yeah, it is. And then from that project, the success with that, you just automatically fell into doing Volcano Blues?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, basically Randy wanted to do a blues album. I mean, he's a, you know, he loves the blues. John Philippe always felt he was a great blues player. He just had that deep feel. So, you know, we talked about that, who we wanted to use in the band, and that's what we did. Same, basically, so similar sort of thing.
Yeah. And at what point did was it suggested that Johnny Copeland come in?
Randy, I think, had heard Johnny, and Johnny also was recording for Polygram in France.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it was an artist that was basically in the same label.
Yeah.
So, you know, we just worked that out with John Philippe. And it was an interesting session because get to hear Johnny Copeland on acoustic, you know.
Yeah.
Which is unusual. And then we took, you know, teaching him how to hold one sec, right?
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah, sorry, Mike.
Okay, that's no problem.
Where was I at?
You were at Johnny Copeland and playing acoustic.
Yeah, I mean, and the Harvard Blues was the other track, which mm-hmm. was with the band, which it was a bassy tune, actually, I believe.
Yeah.
And Randy always loved it, loved the lyrics, and so it was just a matter of getting the tune and finding what key, you know, that Johnny wanted to sing it in, and you know, teaching him the music.
Now, would it have been too presumptive to have said, let's do an album's worth of material with Johnny Copeland?
Yeah, well, I didn't feel that. Although, you know, Johnny had also done that African blues record before for Rounder.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that. So he was definitely a natural choice because he had felt that affinity, at least, or between the different musics. I think if you were producing a record, then you might say, hey, Randy, what about doing something like that?
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the personal aspect of it. I think Randy was trying to show the blues in a lot of different forms.
I see. But
Johnny
you're saying...
Copeland was, you know, getting right down to the grit of it.
Right.
But he also wanted to do it with, you know... to do the blues in a, like Count Basie, when you talk about the blues, you don't talk about Count Basie.
Yeah.
And basically that's a great blues man. But you don't think of it that way because you always put it under jazz.
Yeah. Although it's, apparently we may start to think of it in those, as a culture in those terms, once Robert Altman's Kansas City comes out.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Now, you moved from there and to BMG.
Yeah, actually, when I left Antilles, you know, we got more integrated into the Polygram Verve family, and I stayed there for about a year, I think, and then I left to go out on my own, actually.
Yeah.
Actually, Volcano Blues was the first project that I worked on out on my own, which came out on Antilles.
Okay.
So I had actually already left when I started working on Volcano Blues.
Now, did Volcano Blues go as smoothly as the Spirits of Our Ancestors?
Yeah, I tell you, I mean, working with Randy, I don't know if you know Randy at all.
No, I don't.
He's a, you know, very spiritual person, very, you know, if it's going to work, it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nothing is contrived or, you know, overthought. One of the things I remember him doing, I think it was... African Village Bedford-Stuyvesant, which starts off solo piano, then the trio, then a soloist, then the whole section, and then each soloist gets a solo.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we took four takes of that, and every, you know, it starts off with the solo piano for one chorus, and there were actually two complete takes and two breakdowns. And we kept on... The solo piano thing, the first time he did it, it was just amazing, and then it was a breakdown. Someone didn't come in on time.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, my God, you know, the tape's rolling. Yeah, the tape's rolling. Because, I'm thinking, like, I probably won't hear an introduction like that again. And the second one, it's even better than the first. And then the third one is better than the first two.
Mm.
you know, and it was just at such a level. And for Randy, it was never, you know, like, it's a gift, but it's always there. You know, it's always going to be something different.
Yeah. Now, were all the players isolated, or did you record them, like, we think of rock, pop players?
Volcano
or,
Blues?
Yeah.
It was different in different things. I mean, we recorded Johnny Copeland separately.
Uh-huh.
From the band. And we, you know, his solo piece was just by himself. But no, basically it was out in the open.
Mm-hmm.
You know, using some baffling. But that was the old RCA Studios.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
Which beautiful studios, quite a history.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really huge open rooms.
So a good bit of bleeding from one.
Yeah. I mean, the things that we did put in isolation would be like percussion.
Uh-huh.
And drums.
Yeah. Do you do a lot of punch-ins and
It depends on, you know, what type of thing you're trying to do and what artist it is.
Uh-huh.
With Randy will just say, let's just do it again.
Yeah.
You know? Because we'll have a better one.
Yeah.
And you have, he has that faith. Can you hold one sec, Mike?
Sure.
Sorry, Mike.
That's all right. Now, so once you came over to BMG, you came in as an executive producer?
Well, I came in as a director of A&R.
Okay.
And, you know, one of the things that I learned, too, is that, because I've never felt like, I mean, you know, of course it's a gas to produce something, but for one thing, I find it's a little bit, you know, if you come in as an A&R person and then you produce all the sessions, that it's a little bit, a lot much, really.
Yeah.
In terms of work. Because you really need to, like, be in the studio all that time.
Uh-huh.
You know, you can't really be in your office and then run back and forth. It's not for me. But one of the other things that I felt was to pull out other producers. Because it's sort of like, when you think of jazz producers, there's not a whole lot.
Yeah.
You know, you see a lot of the same names over and over again.
Exactly.
And I don't have complaints about that in terms of, you know, people's work. I love to hear stuff, but there's a lot of people that I've run over, you know, time who I think would be good producers. And one of the things I was really happy with was using, I don't know if you know Billy Banks. He produced the Steve Therese sessions.
Okay.
The Tough Young Tenor.
Yeah.
So that was one of his first sessions. And, you know, he knew some of the basics, but I just ran through it with him. And, I think he's an excellent producer,
mm-hmm.
You know, and I was able to, like, pull him out and then get him involved, and hopefully, you know, he'll have a career doing that, because
yeah.
I think he's a great, you know, he has a great concept and sound and is organized and has a really good rapport with musicians.
And are you working with this, with Larry Clothier?
Larry Clothier, I mean, I know Larry more from management.
Okay.
Situations, you know, obviously, you know, Roy Hargrove, when I've had to use him in the past, dealt with Larry.
Uh-huh.
But I've never worked with Larry actually as a producer, except these Carmen McRae tapes, which were really live albums.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, he's done, you know, he's managing and producing his acts, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this about your time when you were at PolyGram, too, and producing those recordings. I'm not sure. I knew you did the Patricia Barber.
Right.
Or it was kind of vague to me, but it clicked once you mentioned it. And then the Weston. Were there recordings that you were working on, but you weren't listed? I mean, I've often wondered,
were you not listed as a producer?
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
There were things that I worked on in different capacities. You know, where... trying to think of, you know, I mean, like say Charlie Sepulveda.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was there at all the sessions, but you know, I didn't feel as a producer was really, you know, produced by, I think, Charlie.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he thinks of myself, you know, at me as a producer, but I, you know, I felt, you know, I was executive producer. I was, for me, the executive producer means the person that is able to find the money.
Yeah.
Make the project happen and oversee it.
Right. I mean, comparable to the producer in, producing a film,
right?
More than a director,
right?
Yeah.
So, there were things. I mean, I'm trying to think of, you know, one of the first projects I did was the Brazilian singer Joyce, Music Inside. There was the Harper Brothers date at the Vanguard.
Okay.
Arthur Taylor, actually, which was at the Vanguard. That was, you know, much not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
I worked on the Becky M. Seleko record.
Yeah.
With Jean-Philippe.
Uh-huh.
Which was, you know, which was actually sort of going back the other way. Becky was someone that I wanted to sign at Antilles. And I was trying to work out the deal, and it didn't happen. And when I left, Jean-Philippe called me and said, "Hey, whatever happened to the when are they going to put out the Becky M. Seleko record?" And I said, "You know, they're not going to do the deal." And he said, "Well, give me his numbers," and he got a hold of him, and Jean-Philippe signed him. And then called me back and said, "Hey, would you want to produce this with me?" And I said, "Sure."
Yeah.
Oh, that's...
That's how that happened.
That's how that happened.
Yeah. And then did you plot out the artist on that, who you were going to bring in, or was that already chosen?
I had an idea. He wanted to work with Smitty and Michael Bowie. That was the trio that he really loved. So that was the basic trio. And then it basically, in Becky's case, I think it was more of a wish list. You know, people that he wanted to work with: Joe Henderson, Pharoah Sanders, Abby Lincoln, which is also on the label.
Yeah.
And so we got these people, and Becky's pretty amazing. He doesn't, you know, read music. And so Russell Herrmann at the time, who was working as his manager, was also a musician, was functioning basically in terms of writing out arrangements. So he would, you know, just sit at the piano with Becky and then write all the parts out. Or at least, you know, write a lead sheet for
you. Yeah.
But Becky's got like a million tunes. He could just...
Uh-huh.
You can sit there and you say, "Okay, what do you want? What do you want to hear?" And you know, he'll just play a million different tunes.
Yeah.
That was, you know, the tunes were there. That's what he wanted to do.
Yeah. I probably will not talk to Jean-Philippe. I'm pretty well sticking with American producers. But does he work in a kind of classic? What's his style as a producer?
I think he's, you know, one of the better producers, and I don't even think about it in terms of whether it's American or not, because mainly most of his acts are American, and everything's recorded here anyway.
Right.
Does
he come to the States much?
Yeah, he's here.
I should try to talk to him.
More often than his wife would like.
Okay. Yeah.
I
should try to talk to him.
Yeah, I should give him a call.
Yeah.
I think he is in Paris. I just left him. He was actually working on the Charlie Hayden record there.
Okay. I'll call Jody.
No, I have it. You want his number? I can give it to you.
Oh, sure. This is his number in France.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where are we at? Okay. It's 011-331, and then it's 444-419-351.
Okay.
All right. Just tell him I said to
I sure will.
Give him a call.
Okay.
But I think of him as like one of the saviors, really.
Yeah.
In terms of just believing in things and going after them. And even spending big money and making it make sense. And I think if you talk to any of the musicians that deal with him, it's just such a good rapport.
Yeah.
You know, it isn't a forced thing. He believes in them. And he lets them, you know, do their thing, and it works.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not the same kind of music at all, but he's done for the careers of some players what Don Was has done for some other people.
Oh, yeah.
You know, really revive those careers. I got one more question, and then I'll let you go. Have you got a great Ornette story for me when you were over at Island Antilles and that part of the world?
Well, you know, the Ornette record that was done there actually was done during, I think it was beforehand. I mean, I just was involved in the reissue of it.
Of Human Feeling?
And looking at, yeah. And
then it dropped off the face of the earth.
Yeah. Actually, I think we didn't reissue it because...
He wanted too much money or something.
No, it was technically owned by Island.
Uh-huh.
I had talked to, I think, his son about possibly just overseeing the reissue of it again. And Juan Ed had brought up the fact that he believed that they had the right to reissue it again. And I looked into the contracts of it, and from what I could tell from the business affairs, you know, Island did, but I felt, you know, if Ornette did not want it out, then, you know, I wasn't going to make him crazy.
Yeah.
About it, so, you know, I thought it was something great to have out, but I think it would have been a little bit selfish of me to, you know, say, you know, fuck it.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's on paper and you signed your life away, so.
Yeah, yeah. That had happened to him enough times, probably.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that album was done, Ron Goldstein was the president of Island then.
Yeah.
And who now runs Private Music. I'm not sure if Steve Backer was there then. He may have been there then.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember seeing his name on the recording.
But I have not really had a lot of dealings with Ronette. You know, Jean-Philippe, when he was signing him, met him up at the studio. And a good friend of mine actually was the designer for their offices and studios on 125th Street.
Uh-huh.
So I just met him up there and I was just waiting. I know DiNardo very well. We talk a lot.
Yeah.
We ended up going all the way downtown to his favorite place to have some real, I guess, Texas cooking. Acme.
Okay.
Southern Texas style. So he would make that trip from 125th down to basically 3rd Street.
Yeah.
You know, just to have that food.
Yeah. Well, the time I met him, I was in Atlanta, and he was looking for some barbecue. He had just come in from Germany. He was serious about getting some good barbecue in Atlanta.
I hear him.
That was the quest.
I understand that.
Me too.
But Jean-Philippe would probably have some great stories about Ornette.
Yeah, yeah.
I just heard the new music, actually. A few tunes from the new album that's about to come out.
Is that right? I haven't heard a thing from it.
Yeah, no. When I was in France, they just played some of it on DAT for me.
Is it funk or is it
There's one tune that's very, very funky.
Uh-huh.
But it's Ornette.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's definitely Ornette. I liked what I heard a lot.
I mean, I love that thing on that. I guess it's on Antilles.
Yeah, Human Feelings. Yeah.
I mean, it's way up there with Parliament for me and Funkadelic.
Yeah.
It's
well, you know, he did that record, and then the next record I think he did. Well, he did the records that Live at the Caravan of Dreams stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was the one on Epic, Virgin Beauty.
Yeah.
Jerry Garcia.
Right.
That record I liked a lot too.
I did too.
Yeah. You know what's interesting about the Of Human Feelings? I think was one of the first digital recordings.
Huh.
If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember who the engineer was on it, but I think it was recorded actually to 2-track strictly digital.
Now you work on Spirit of Our Ancestors and Volcano Blues. You were working with how many tracks?
Oh, multi-track.
Yeah.
Hold one sec.
Okay.
That was Jack Walrath.
Oh, yeah.
Volcano Blues, Spirits of Our Ancestors.
16-track, 32-track stuff.
Yeah, the 24-track, maybe.
Uh-huh.
Or 32-track digital in some cases.
Yeah.
But those are all multi-track recordings. The stuff that I've done live, the 2-track, mainly is like live things.
Uh-huh.
The Arthur Taylor.
Yeah.
Live at the Vanguard, the Harper Brothers Live at the Vanguard.
Mm-hmm.
It's different, you know, it's a different process because you have to get your mix there. You know, you're literally live mixing it down to 2 tracks. So you don't have the ability to go back and do it. But sometimes, actually, I've worked with James Nichols. I've worked with a lot, an engineer, someone uh-huh. I really like, very versatile engineer. And he'll do things sometimes where you're thinking about it as a live to 2-track date, but he'll run like one reel of 24-track. So you're running the 24-track, and then what you do is a quick mix so you can sort of correct things.
Oh, yeah.
And then you just, you know, you, you use the same tape over again.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're not doing the whole thing where you, you, everything's a multi, and then you set up a whole new thing for mixing.
Yeah.
But that's a neat way to do it, to get a good live two-track sound.
Well, Brian, thanks so much for talking to me.
You're quite welcome.
And something will come out, something from this conversation will come out. I it'll take forever, but when it comes out, I'll send you a copy.
Okay, thank you.
It'll probably be helpful. In the spring sometime. And, you know, like I said, something for Tower Pulse and perhaps and probably also for Jazz Is.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks a ton.
Take
See
care,
you.
Mike.
Bye.